I may not have a license to kill, but liberalism dies a little every time I pull the trigger on it. This is a conservative's perspective.
Announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're standing by for further word from Honolulu, and we expect to rejoin them in just a moment. However, here's a bulletin which has just come into the NBC newsroom in New York. Nomura, the Japanese ambassador, and Kurusu, the special Japanese envoy, were at the State Department at the time of the White House's announcement of the attacks on Hawaii. The two Japanese went to see Secretary of State Hull at 1:35 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and remained about 20 minutes. Back in New York City, here's a bulletin. Honolulu, Japanese bombs killed at least 5 persons and injured many others, 3 seriously, in a surprise morning aerial attack today on Honolulu. The sky was filled with puffs of smoke from exploding shells fired by American Army and Navy anti-aircraft units. Whether surface vessels of the United States fleet were in action against the enemy could not be learned at once, but columns of water rising from the sea as shells hit the water indicated a naval action. Viewed from the hills back of Honolulu, where many city folk went to view the fight, columns of heavy black smoke went skyward from Pearl Harbor. Another bulletin, the Secretary of War has just announced that all military personnel on active duty is to appear Monday in uniform.
Then manufacturers, wholesalers, and distributors will have to help in making adjustments so that the squeeze will be distributed as equitably as possible.
Bricknell, while you were talking, I've just learned that the Japanese are now bombing Burma. This is an act that may lead the United States to war against Japan. It may lead Canada to more active military effort against Japan. I merely mention this to show how fast events are moving while we're discussing these adjustments that are being made in the Canadian and American economy during the war. But to pursue this question of price control further.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special broadcast.
Here's the bulletin. Washington, the president decided today after Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor and Manila to call an extraordinary meeting of the cabinet for 8:30 p.m. tonight and to have congressional leaders of both parties join the conference at 9 p.m. And now we take you to Honolulu.
This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. We should like to now try to call in Manila, the capital of the Philippine Commonwealth. Go ahead, Manila. This is CBS in America calling Manila. Go ahead. We regret that we are unable to contact either Honolulu or Manila. We return you now to William L. Shirer in New York.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York.
Hey, everybody. James Bostic here, Conservative's Perspective on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you aren't listening, you should be, because it's the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio. mojo50.com. 83 years ago today, Pearl Harbor, our naval installation at Oahu, Hawaii, was attacked by the Japanese, thrusting the United States into the maelstrom of the Second World War. For the last decade or so, We here at Conservative's Perspective have always presented a Pearl Harbor retrospective on this day. Their stories, principally their words, and after I share with you what I'm going to share, their voices. But for now, here's the nightmare. You're a 15-year-old kid, and one fine Sunday morning in December, you're standing on something called the aft boatwell deck of the mighty United States battleship Arizona. Off in the distance, you and your pal, Seaman First Class William Stafford, hear something that sounds like thunder. You and Stafford, an older friend from home who happens to be a sailor assigned to Arizona, are standing there talking, wondering. Across the shipping channel, columns of smoke suddenly begin to billow. What the hell's going on? More to the point, what's a 15-year-old sailor, strictly a visitor on board the battleship, to do? You'd lied, of course, to get into the peacetime Navy. Girls, you know, they just love that uniform. But those nearby explosions are not exactly routine. Could it be some kind of gunnery practice? And those planes up in the sky, black line after line, coming our way. Out there, across the water, goes a smaller ship. A destroyer, or a mine layer, perhaps. A bomb hits and breaks her in half, and that does it. Aboard Arizona, general quarters is sounded. Everyone on board, hundreds of sailors now run, racing pell-mell to their battle stations. Your friend Stafford goes, too. I have to. I'll see you later. And so he's gone. Well, of course, friend or no friend, he's got a battle station to go to, like everyone else does. It's his duty. And so, with the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, with a devastating surprise attack on the U.S. fleet, with all that death and destruction that brought the United States into World War II, with sheer pandemonium around you. An explosion rends the ship, then a second one, and the crew runs and screams. Guns begin to fire back into the sky. Your friend's gone to his duty station. With all that, you're now standing at the stern of the mighty ship all alone. Alone and wondering, can't this please just be a nightmare? But for young Martin Matthews, born in Shelbyville, Kentucky, it was no nightmare. He really was there at Pearl Harbor. He really was only 15 years old at the time, and he really was in the United States Navy. But this wasn't his usual duty station. He was stationed nearby at Ford Island Naval Air Station, which was also under attack. As the last hours of peacetime were disintegrating for America, he had been visiting his pal Stafford aboard Arizona the night of December 6th. After breakfast on that morning, December 7th, 1941, they had planned to go sightseeing ashore. But first, they took a tour of the mighty battle wagon. And what was one of the last things the 15-year-old said to his pal? Wasn't it something like, "I wish I could get duty aboard a battleship." It was one of the last things Matthews ever said to his friend, who was among the crewmen killed as Arizona was broken and sunk on that date, which will live in infamy, as President Franklin D. Roosevelt termed it so well, when he went before Congress the next day in Washington, D.C. to demand and get a declaration of war. The fact that the day would live in infamy would be no solace to Martin Matthews as he watched the devastating attack unfurl before him. He watched as a boy, none too happy to be there, to see such terrible sights. I think the second bomb that hit was close to the aft deck that I was on, and needless to say, I was petrified. The concussions knocked him down a couple of times, and he sought cover. "This is not what I went into the Navy for," said Matthews, "and it was not what I wanted. Besides, I had no place to go. I didn't have a general quarters station on Arizona." As chance would have it, if he had to be at Pearl Harbor, he was in the worst place of all. Arizona's death toll of 1,103 was more than half the total number of men in the Pacific Fleet to die at Pearl Harbor that day. Matthews, however, didn't stay aboard the stricken ship all that long. He could never be sure later if he jumped or was blown overboard, but he found himself in the water at the stern of the battleship, still fully clothed in his dress whites for sightseeing. He swam to a mooring buoy 20 to 30 yards away, as he explained later in an interview for the book Remembering Pearl Harbor. And there he clung for the remainder of the attack, unharmed, despite the chunks of metal and timber flying through the air in his direction. Pieces of bodies, too. It was far too much for a young boy of 15 to have witnessed, said Matthews. While the Japanese planes came wave after wave for nearly 2 hours in all, he couldn't very well swim to nearby Ford Island since its naval air facility was also under attack. Most of the American aircraft over there he could see had been bombed and set on fire or blown apart. The attacking Japanese seemed to be completely unmolested. Closer at hand, though, the ill-fated Arizona was in her final moments of agony. There was ammunition, gun lockers, shells, steel fragments, and pyrotechnics coming from all parts of the ship, Matthews said. It was like a fireworks display. There was a series of explosions, not just one deafening roar. But there was one decisive moment. Things came to a final one where she seemed like the middle part of the ship just raised up in the water and kind of half buckled, then settled back down. And that was the end. The battleship couldn't sink out of sight because the water wasn't that deep, but that was the end anyway. Her bridge and masthead were above water. I remember that after she finally settled. It was also about that time that the attack waned. Martin swam to the beach at Ford Island, where for days after he helped clean up the incredible mess the Japanese had left behind. So incredible, he subsequently said, that 3 whole days later, he and his buddies found an American pilot still trapped in his wrecked airplane at the end of the runway. Martin Matthews remained a U.S. Navy sailor for the duration of the war. He served aboard 8 ships and earned a Navy Commendation Medal. He went to college after the war and then went to work to make a living, just like most other people. Like most, except that he goes down in history as a Pearl Harbor survivor, as one of the youngest survivors. And what else, perhaps? Oh, yes, those 8 ships that he served on later in the war, 3 of them were sunk out from under him as well. And now at this point, the voices that you hear next will be the voices of the men who were there and survived that date, which will live in infamy. We do this with a great deal of pride and in remembrance of these men. So without any further ado, A Conservative Perspective now presents to you Pearl Harbor, a collection of eyewitness accounts.
I'd just been married for 5 months. We were having breakfast when the first bombs dropped. We turned on the radio.
And a severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by airplane.
200 miles off Hawaii, 6 Japanese aircraft carriers under Admiral Yamamoto had launched 353 aircraft led by Commander Mitsuo Fushida in a surprise attack against the Pacific Fleet. Jim scrambled from his house toward his ship, the USS West Virginia, berthed on Battleship Row.
So the first airplane that came my direction was all drab. I thought it was an Army plane. Then he came flying low and slow. He had machine guns. The bullets went right over my head. That's when the war became very personal.
Simultaneous air attacks were underway at 6 U.S. airfields. The first wave of attack along Battleship Row crippled or sunk the might of the U.S. Pacific Fleet.
We were tied up with the Oklahoma in front of us and the Arizona behind. The Oklahoma capsized and turned over. So here we were with the Oklahoma upside down in front of us and the Arizona burning like a volcano behind.
Jim first boarded the flaming deck of the USS Tennessee and slid down its 5-inch gun barrel onto the West Virginia. Massive torpedo strikes had already sunk the West Virginia into the shallow waters.
I could see the fire spreading toward the ammunition. I took a fire hose from the Tennessee and tried to cool the ammunition so it wouldn't explode because the fire was spreading to everything above the waterline.
Millions of gallons of crude oil from the USS Arizona, Oklahoma, California, and four other damaged or sinking battleships ignited the water in flames.
Oil is lighter than water, so it stayed at the top. And to see sailors being blown over the side into that oily water, sink underneath, come up, and the oil was on fire, and to see their bodies just burn like a human torch, that was the worst experience I could imagine, is seeing those human torches burning. I ran the whole gamut of emotions. The first was surprise. And then there was fear, and it turned to anger that our leadership had let us down. And then there was pride to see our men without leadership instinctively doing the right thing.
As the second wave of attacks swooped in on the USS Nevada, Jim says he felt peace while fighting the inferno.
I felt like, Lord, I'll be with you in a minute. And I fully expected to be. So I had the deepest peace I've ever felt in my life. And I think that was it. I'm going to be with you in a minute.
Jim's faith in God didn't begin in the heat of battle either.
Years earlier, aboard the West Virginia, Jim lived and worked alongside a group of Christian shipmates.
I was very unhappy. But Virgil was one of this group. Sing a tune, face shining, looked like he's the happiest person in the world. I knew it was Christ in him. I was attracted to Christ because of the quality of life of the guys I saw who were Christians. It was more the Battleship West Virginia that I gave my life to Christ because I wanted what these other people had.
Then in that crucial hour when lives were at stake, and later, when his shipmates needed comfort in death, God's peace led Jim.
I knew many of them that I saw killed. We lost 108 that morning. They went down fighting. They went down trying to protect the ship and each other. I felt like it. Everybody was a hero.
After all the fires were out, Jim rushed to the hospital. Over 3,500 Americans were dead or wounded.
My friends were burned, so I took a notebook and went down the line of these guys in suspension and said, if you give me your parents' address and dictate a note, I'll see that they get it. The main surprise was how optimistic they were. And they told their parents, don't worry about it, I'll be all right. And they knew that George M. would die that night. But I liked their optimism.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
The next day, the United States declared war on Japan.
This was going to be a long war.
Battles in the Pacific theater alone resulted in 35 million casualties, 3% of the world's population. 100,000 civilian casualties at Okinawa heavily influenced America's use of two atomic bombs against Japan to end World War II. Jim was stationed in Washington, D.C. at the war's end, grateful the 400 gunnery trainees under his command would enjoy civilian life once again.
We were relieved that it was over. We were too close to disaster. It must never happen again.
At 102 years old, Jim is the second oldest surviving veteran of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
My admonition out of Pearl Harbor is, remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert and strong. Because I believe that weakness invites aggression. And we must never be weak as a nation, or aggression will result.
After Jim retired from the U.S. Navy, to his surprise, he met and befriended Japan's Pearl Harbor attack commander, Mitsuo Fushida.
I met him and talked with him on several occasions. A missionary gave Fushida a Bible, and he became a Christian and became an evangelist.
They fought against each other in war, but through Christ, discovered a brotherhood of peace.
I have a favorite verse, Ezekiel 36:23. God himself said, "The nations will know me when they see me in you."
My name is Don Long. I served in the Navy. I happened to be at Pearl Harbor in 1941 after enlisting in March of 1941 in Minnesota. Farm kid, manure still on my shoes. Got to Hawaii in November of 1941. Was assigned to an aircraft squadron, PBYs. I was a radioman. We were based at Kaneohe Bay in Hawaii. It's right across the island from Pearl Harbor. And that's where I was on December 7th, 1941.
This broadcast brings you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
December 7th, 1941. A date which will live in infamy. United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
I'd finished radio school in Alameda and got assigned to Hawaii, which of course I think was every young farm boy's dream in those days. The morning of December 7th, that the squadron that I was in, we had some planes on the water, and I was in one of those airplanes. The procedure is that if there is a plane anchored on the water, that somebody's in it at all times, quote, just in case. I had just relieved the fellow who got off, who was on the plane the night before. It was about 7:45 in the morning, and I was getting ready for the day's activities that we had planned. We were gonna do a little signal practicing with the shore, and I heard some airplanes overhead. I looked out, I saw some planes up in the air. I thought it was the Army Air Force doing some Sunday maneuvers. Moments later, the plane started coming in my direction, and one of them opened fire, strafing the airplane that I was in. Just about the same time, there were bombs going off, exploding, when the overhead bombers, they were dropping bombs on the shore establishment, on the hangars, the airplanes on the ground. The planes, we had them all lined up there at the base, and the strafing airplanes, the incoming planes, were strafing the planes on the ground and on the water. The plane that I was in was hit, I'm going to say, almost instantly. It burst into flame. The gas tanks did not have bulletproof rubber liners in them in those days, and the plane and everything was immediately engulfed in fire. I just had, happened to be in the middle of it. I can recall seeing the little spouts of water shooting up when where the bullets went through the bottom of the plane. This was on my way trying to get out, which I did. I went to the back blister of the airplane and jumped into the water. At the time, the water, of course, was all aflame with gas and oil. But at boot camp, fortunately, they had taught us how to swim through a burning, quote, water. And that's what I did. You just jump in feet first with hands over your head, such like this, and then go under the water. Stay as long as you can, swim as far away as you can. And then when you need air to come up, and then with your hands, just wave them back and forth, spread the flames, come up for a second, 2 seconds, gulp of air, go back down, swim off and do it again. So that worked well for me. There was a buoy a couple of hundred yards away that I saw. I swam over to that. My logic at the time, I can recall, was that I thought if they would try to strafe me in the water, if they saw me, that I could climb under that buoy. And I thought I might be protected. That never happened. I want to add that there was never any action at me directly. They were attacking the planes and the hangars, but I didn't see anything that I thought was coming after me as an individual. A little while later, I noted a boat was coming out from the shore, and they were out there looking for survivors, and they came over and picked me up. Fortunately for me, but unfortunately for the other guys, I was the only one that did survive the strafing of the planes that were on the water and stuff. The fast forward 75 years. 2 years ago, I was invited to go back to Pearl Harbor. I had been there before, but I invited to go back with a group for the 75th Pearl Harbor anniversary. It incidentally put in a plug for the Greatest Foundation. They were the ones that took us back there, and it was a very memorable trip.
My name is Tom Mahoney. I'm 89 years old. I'm from Union, New Jersey, and I'm one of the few Pearl Harbor survivors left in New Jersey. My most vivid memory of December 7th, 1941 was I had breakfast with five of my best friends that we went through boot camp together less than a year ago, and we had breakfast. We planned to go to Mass on one of the battleships at 8 o'clock. We were waiting for the launch. I went down to the electric shop where I was a striker, and while waiting, we heard boom, boom, and the ship began to roll. I looked out the porthole on the next deck up to see a plane dropping its torpedoes into the old Utah. These five boys went to their general quarter stations. We were all dressed in dress whites, ready to go to shore, church. And the next time I saw my friends was around 3 o'clock when the handling room of Gun Mount 3 cooled down and we opened the door and they were nothing but charcoal. They had taken the full blast of the bomb. This is etched in my brain and never will be forgotten. Later in the evening, when everything cooled down, all the metal, I went through the wreckage down to the main deck where there was four or five fellows looking at a huge sunset. It's the biggest one I ever seen in my life. I says, you will pay for this over and over again. I turned to the fellow next to me, which all of us were covered with oil, blood, soot from the fires, and we couldn't tell each other apart. Our new dress whites that we're going to go ashore in were torn and black. I turned to the fellow next to me on the rail. I said, "Did you hear anything about the Mahoney boys?" He says, "Who the hell are you?" I says, "I'm Tom Mahoney." He says, "I'm your brother Harold." We hugged and cried like the kids we really were. We've been a close-knit association for many, many years. And each one of us considered the other person a brother. We got to know their families, and we'll never forget. And I will continue to carry on what I've been doing for years, and that's talking to children in high schools and presenting certain associations with a piece, a relic of the Arizona. And I will always remember all the people that I associated with for many, many years. God bless them all. Thank you.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Oh man, that was a hell of a day. I was on the boat deck and I saw the first Japanese plane come over. He came over and he dropped the bomb right down the stack of the Arizona, and it just went apart like that. Sailors went this way, that way, all over. Oh, it was a mess. My name is Master Sergeant Thomas D. Davis, U.S. Marine Corps. I joined the Navy in 1939. I stayed in the Navy 10 years, and then I joined the Marine Corps and stayed in Marine Corps 20 years. And I retired in 1968. Well, I was about less than 2 miles from the battleship row. And when they started bombing, when that first plane came over and dropped his bomb, then he went back. And then, oh, hell broke loose. Then a lot of planes came over. Yeah, see, they had all those battleships in a row. I think it was about three or four battleships. They all would park over there. It wasn't nothing too much they could do, you know. Our planes, the one that wasn't hit, they got out, you know, and went out to intercept the Japanese and fight them off. And that's when all the hell broke loose. Got some of our planes got off the ground, but not too many. At Hickam Field. But see, they thought in their mind, if they knock out the battleship, they had it made because they could land. And those carriers saved us. Because they had those fighters and the interceptors playing out there on them, you know, carriers. And they intercept those Japanese was coming in. And that's what saved us. There's a lot of smoke and fire, a lot of fire. Ship in there got sunk too, right there in the harbor. I know it lasts all that morning. And at night, the submarine tried to attack, and I think they got them. Because I was shook up too, and my focus was on the Arizona at the time. I was watching all that fire was going on. And everything was burning over there, smoke. Oh, gee, couldn't hardly see the harbor on that side. the guy that went in the Navy with me, he was on Arizona. So he had a duty that morning, and I was off. So he told me, said, Dave said, why don't you come over and spend the night with me, and then we'll go up in town the next day. I said, heck, I'll stay on my own ship. Today he not here. Just looking. That's all I could do. Our battle station was the on the ship, they called it the sick bay, to take care of the wounded, you know, when they come in. I watched the whole thing. Yeah. It was something, I'm telling you, something I never want to see again.
This is James Bostic with Conservative's Perspective. I hope that you are enjoying this retrospective on Pearl Harbor. In my studies as an amateur historian, and they have been pretty extensive in this particular window into 20th century America from the 1920s, basically the end of the First World War up to the end of the Second World War, in my opinion, I think that the attack on Pearl Harbor was most likely the single most galvanizing moment in the history, in America's history, in the 20th century. There have been a number of moments throughout the arc of time for the United States that have been seminal, and they've been rallying points. But in the 20th century, I think the attack on Pearl Harbor was the most significant. Support for the war encompassed all areas of American culture. Overnight, young men all over the country were enlisting into the various military services in response to what happened at Pearl Harbor. And in those days, the Hollywood elite were no exception. Many of Hollywood's leading men enlisted in the war. Many others who could not do that served in other capacities. They were in movies, supporting the war. They were in radio programs. They were on posters. They were doing war bond drives all over the country. Everyone was supporting the United States in this war. The music industry, no different, and that's what I'm leading up to here. I'm going to play a couple musical selections from that time frame, and then we will move on with more of ACP's Pearl Harbor Retrospective.
To accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You got to spread joy up to the maximum, bring gloom down to the minimum, have faith or pandemonium, liable to walk upon the scene.
To illustrate his last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do just when everything looked so dark?
Man, they said we better accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No, do not mess with Mr. In-Between. Do you hear me?
Listen to me, chillin', Anna. You will hear about the eliminating of the negative and an accent on a positive.
Gather round me, chillin', if you're willing, and sit tight while I start reviewing the attitude of doing right.
You gotta accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between.
You got to spread joy
up to the maximum,
bring gloom
down
to the minimum,
then Otherwise,
pandemonium liable to walk upon the sea.
To illustrate,
well, illustrate
my last remark,
you got the floor.
Jonah
in the whale, Noah
in
the
ark. What did they say?
What did they say?
Say when everything looks so dark. Man, they said we better accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. Latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No, don't mess with Mr. In-Between.
The Japanese Zero hit Kaneohe, Naval Air Station Kaneohe Bay, first, 7:48. 11 Zeros came in on Kaneohe Bay. They had a top speed of 310 miles an hour. They were faster than anything stationed in Oahu, heavily armed. They had a 20-millimeter cannon in each wing and two 7.7 machine guns, 500 rounds for each machine gun, 60 rounds for each cannon. And they did one heck of a lot of damage.
I was watching out toward the hangars, and the guys were getting mowed down left and right. I think we had five hangars. Anyway, they bombed all five of those and wiped those out. Got every plane except for I think there was two in Midway. And we had one plane in the water with a full crew on it. And of course they got that one too. They were PBYs.
The Navy's long range patrol aircraft, the PBYs, PBY-5s on the ground at Kaneohe. They destroyed or so heavily damaged they were of no use. They virtually destroyed the Navy's long-range patrol capability in that one strike.
I just couldn't believe this was happening until I see all them red balls on their planes. So, oh yeah, it's happening.
They worked over Kaneohe with those 11 Zeros, the first wave. Cliff was in his barracks, as I recall, at that time.
Had a hangover from Saturday night. And so we heard this noise and jumped up, ran to the front of the barracks, and we saw the plane, jet planes, another flight came over. And then we saw the red ball, and the bombs were going off.
And they came in at a lower altitude, the second wave against Kaneohe, because they had already learned there was no air defense there except for whatever people could grab in the way of automatic weapons.
We had our guns set up and we're firing, but there was no, they were coming in real low and slow. They didn't have anything to fear.
The man beside him was feeding the belt. He took a hit from apparently shrapnel in the back.
And it left a hole about the size of my fist. And when he fell, he tore the belt, the ammunition belt, tore it out of the way from the gun, and it jammed it. And I could not fix it, so I couldn't keep on firing.
Cliff didn't think the man possibly was gonna make it, but sure enough, he did.
The morning of the 7th, we were the Enterprise launched this at 200 miles from Ford Island or Honolulu.
The carrier was actually scheduled to be back in Pearl Harbor Saturday afternoon, the 6th.
And this was the scouting hop looking for the Japanese fleet.
Routine was to launch a scouting squadron out in front of the carriers. They could reach out further than the radar could beyond the horizon.
So we had radio silence, and Halsey said, if you break radio silence, I'll court-martial you.
And they heard a radio transmission that was unusual, to say the least.
We heard, don't shoot, this is an American plane.
And it was one of their pilots who said, don't shoot, I'm an American.
And, you know, after we got into Pearl, we found out who it was, and they never found them.
Jack was in the back cockpit, and they had his canopy open, and they could smell the burning oil coming from what was going on at Pearl Harbor. Ray was a 20-year-old Marine from the small town of Waterloo, Alabama. He heard over the sound system in the Oklahoma air raid, the urgency of it, convinced him something bad was happening, and of course it was. The torpedoes were already in the water.
First thing I noticed was the announcement over the public address system. They said, man the anti-aircraft battery. It was just sudden. Just like throwing a bucket of cold water in your face, you know? Couldn't believe it. And one of my friends was looking out the porthole, and he said, I saw him lay a torpedo. I said, let me see, and I started to look out the window, and about that time, water hit me in the face.
He felt the strikes of torpedoes while this incident was going on.
Felt like the ship jumped out of the water about 3 feet. And then shortly thereafter, there was a second torpedo.
The ship was rapidly listing. 13 minutes after the first bombs were falling, you can see the foremast of the Oklahoma at an angle of about 30 to 40 degrees. She's already listing that fast. At 8:15, the Oklahoma was on its side.
And I heard some people hollering for help. And some people struggling trying to get out of a porthole. And I went to their aid. And I pulled five sailors out of the porthole. Somebody was inside, was pushing them up. And the ship's chaplain was on the inside. He said, I've already tried, I can't get out. And I offered him my hand, I said, I'll try to pull you out. And he walked away, and he said, I'm gonna look around and see if there's any more guys that I can help get out here. So I waited a few minutes. He never came back. Never saw him again.
And all of a sudden I hear, boom. And then I hear the damnedest explosions you would ever want to hear outside. You know, I ran to the back doors, and I looked to my right, and I saw hangars 7 and 9 blow up. And then I see these little pepper things kicking up on the asphalt, and these guys are running, and I look up, and here comes a plane right at me, Japanese plane.
Just at the last minute, evidently the Japanese pilot saw power lines coming at him. So he jerked his nose up and pulled off the attack.
If he had held that doggone trigger another half second, I wouldn't be here, because I was right in his line of fire. And when he flew over, I looked up, wow. Then I knew what was happening. And from then on, man, it was just chaos all over everywhere.
What he was describing was a Val dive bomber. And their mission was, you drop your bomb, and then you take your strafing capability to Hickam Field.
We lost about 95% of all the aircraft that we had on Hickam, either damaged or destroyed. We had very few planes that could fly after that attack. And Wheeler Field was in about the same shape. Right after that's when I ran down to the motor pool.
Ed spent the rest of that day picking up wounded in his truck with other people, picking up bodies, including the bodies of a young lieutenant.
I saw some pretty nasty things, like that lieutenant that I picked up. He was damn near cut in half.
It was across from Battleship Row and saw that horrible sight there. Arizona sitting on the bottom, flames towering up into the air. Burning oil had drifted down on the Tennessee, which was moored just forward of the Arizona.
Bob Border, as it turned out, was home in the apartment the morning of the attack. The irony was, on Friday night, or early Saturday morning, he was officer of the deck on the Tennessee, and he came off, as I recall, about 6 o'clock, 600 hours in the morning.
It was such mixed emotions, I'm not sure I could just describe them. There was anger, there was horror. Well, watching bodies of people float by and knowing that there were a lot of people killed was very depressing. We didn't know the extent of everything that had happened, of course.
It was a normal Hawaii day, you know, and I got up early, showered and everything, and was just getting my clothes on, closing my locker when the alarm went. Popped up the top side as quick as I could, just in time to see the Utah capsizing. And she was going all the way. She wasn't just leaning, she was capsizing. She turned totally upside down. And I was looking right at Battleship Row, right across the point of the island, and I saw the Arizona take the big one, that big carry, that classic shot that we have, you know. I saw it, and I thought, oh my God. Because I had about 40, 50 personal friends on board. On Saturday night, we had a battle of bands at the rec center. My band took fourth place. The Arizona took second, and the captain of the Arizona walked over to Lee Shockey, who was the bandmaster of the band, and he says, I'm very proud of you. And he says, I'll tell you what. He says, tomorrow morning, you guys can sleep in. And that's where they are today.
And of course, the whole band was lost in that explosion, which incidentally took the lives. Well, there were 1,177 people.
Emotions run pretty deep, and I've been about 500 or 600 yards away from it. That's the closest I've got to it. I still don't feel that I could go to that memorial, because I don't think I could. I think I'd break right down entirely. And tears come easy, I'll tell you, in situations like that.
There's a lot of people in this country do not even know what Pearl Harbor means.
I won't get over it.
I was where I was at, and that was it. I was going to live and die there and there. And that's really the way that I felt.
We had no idea what was coming up next.
Because you weren't sure of what was going to happen tomorrow. You didn't know whether you'd be alive or not.
I forgave the Japanese many, 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 many years ago. You can forgive, but you never forget.
December 7, 1941 really was a day that changed this nation forever. There's no question about it. Because that day pushed this nation, shoved this nation, drove this nation into the most destructive war in human history. But it also taught us something else, that you cannot stand idly by when tyrants are stalking the earth. You could certainly call World War II catastrophe in and of itself, perhaps. But there was another level of catastrophe beyond that, and that was, if the United States had not entered the war on the side of Great Britain in the Atlantic and against the Japanese in the Pacific, the world would be totally different today. Totally different.
Now,
yeah.
Okay, I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old with mother's permission. In those days they had what they called minority crews, and you could go in at 17. So I never finished high school. And I joined the Navy in 1938, so I had over 3 years in when the war started here, and I was right out here on the battleship Oklahoma. And my station was in the engine room, and there were 54 men in my division. So far as I know, only four of us survived out of the 54. There may have been some others, but that's all I had heard of. So I was pretty fortunate there. And I stayed on the ship until it listed about 30 degrees. And then I thought it was time to leave, because 30 degrees is getting over there pretty good. And when I got to the top side, it went on over. My buddy was with me. He went uphill and went over to the battleship Maryland, which we were tied up to. And it was too steep for me to go up there by the time I got out the ventilator, and I slid down into the water. So I had to swim. And
how far did you have to swim?
Well, I swam just as I slid down there, the ship turned over onto me and covered me. So I tried to swim out from under it, and I was an excellent swimmer, but I couldn't find the surface. There was something over the top of me. So I finally gave up. And finally, I ended up in a life raft. How I got there, I don't know. I think it was due to either an explosion or the ship making a sudden movement and forced me out of the water. I don't know. But I ended up in a life raft.
Do you think you were unconscious at that time?
As what?
Do you think you were unconscious at that time?
I was. I was. Because I had given up.
Hmm.
But then after I was in the life raft for a few minutes, got my breath back again, and the fellas had a couple of wounded men in the life raft, and they gave me the dickens for jumping into the life raft. I don't know. I didn't know how I got there. So I knew I wasn't wanted, so I jumped back in the water and started swimming over here to the submarine base. This is what was my goal. And actually, my ship was right out there where the Missouri is. So it's quite a swim from there to here.
Oh, yeah.
But I swam probably a fourth of the way, and I was picked up by a motor launch. But then I got back over here to the submarine base, and I heard that they had heard some tapping on the hull of the Oklahoma. If you've seen pictures of it, about a third of the hull was still above water. And so I went back out there and I worked on it for 2 days. We were cutting people out, and we rescued 32 men. And that's where I spent the next 2 days. And then after that, I went out to sea. I grabbed the first destroyer I could get on and went to sea, because I wanted to kill a Jap. Okay. That was my goal.
Can you stay?
I'm 104 years old, and I'm the oldest living Pearl Harbor survivor. I was a Naval Reservist. I joined about 5 years before the war started. We assembled here in San Diego, and then from San Diego, they assigned us to a minesweeper, and then they sent us to Pearl Harbor. On the 6th of December, at night, we go on the operation, sleeping right outside the harbor. That morning, we spotted the submarine trying to get in the harbor, and we reported to the USS Ward, and then we thought it was the end of our duty. I went home and went to bed because I was so tired. I hadn't slept in all night, and I told my wife I didn't want to eat breakfast. I just wanted to get some sleep, which I did. And then after I thought it was about 5-10 minutes of sleep, she came over into our bedroom and called me and told me that everything was on fire, that we were being attacked. I went out and saw the harbor on fire and all black smoke from the oil from the ships burning. And so it was dark, black dark. And I felt terrible to see all those ships on fire and the men struggling to keep alive in the oily water. Tears came to my eyes because of the destruction of the ships and, more important, the lives that were lost. I never will forget it. I went through the whole 4 years of combat. I was on troop transport. It was named LaSalle, USS LaSalle. Some of them came back all torn apart. I just couldn't handle it anymore, so I did my job, and that's what I did. When I got discharged, I just took some time off, and then we first rented a house in Mission Hills. Then we started saving, and we bought a house. My daughter had grown up, and she met this young man. He was from the Navy, too. They got married and had a granddaughter for me.
They were all very young. The baby was about a year old. The girl was about 18, and the boy was probably about 19. And they were going up to L.A., and they were hit head-on by another car, and they were killed.
They killed my daughter and my granddaughter instantly, and he passed away about 2 hours later. It was quite a shock, especially to Margaret, my wife. She went to her grave thinking about them. We missed Peggy, and one day we were talking about the accident, and she suggested, why don't we adopt?
So they went to the adoption agency, they told me, and asked them if they could find an older child, not a baby. And so they came up with me, and I was 5 years old at the time, and that's how they got me and I got them.
She just filled the empty gap that we had there. We didn't treat her any different than anybody else.
My name is Francis Emond, that's E-M-O-N-D. I was born in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. And I was raised there until we went through high school. I worked in a mill for a couple of years, and I joined the Navy in 1938.
Is there a legacy of service in your family?
No, there is not. Most of my parents, my family, were French. They came down from Canada to work in the mills in New England.
When you joined the Navy, what was your motivation for doing so?
My main motivation was to get out of the mill where I worked, because it looked like I was going to be there my whole life. So I wanted to do something a little bit more than that. I heard a radio broadcast that the Navy was looking for musicians, and I had been a French horn player in high school, so I applied for the Navy, and I was one of the few to be selected to join the Navy.
Did you enjoy playing the French horn?
Yes, I enjoyed it very much. I played it all the way through high school, but then I hadn't played it for 2 years until I joined the Navy. So it was my instrument.
Tell us a little bit about your training when you joined.
When I joined the Navy, I went to Norfolk for recruit training. And at Norfolk, I received my uniform and a bunch of shots and indoctrination for about a month into the Navy. And then they sent me back up to Washington, D.C. to the School of Music.
So what was it like playing in the U.S. Navy Band?
Well, it was fine playing in the bands. We always enjoyed that. I was assigned to Navy Band number 8. There was 23 players and one leader. So we lived together and we worked together, and we were a unit. So it was nice to be a part of a group.
Take us through a typical day in the U.S. Navy Band, your day, your duty, and what have you.
If aboard the ships, of course, I did most of my time on the ships. If the ship was in port, we would play Morning Colors, and then be rehearsed a little bit maybe, and then we'd set up during the noontime lunch hour. And we play all through that. And then the evening, we would do the same. We were in the evening, at noontime, we'd play some real light music. And sometime in the evening, we would set up a stage band and play some of that, and then some marches and that. If we were at sea duty, if we were steaming at sea, on the Pennsylvania, our station was on the aft mast. Top the mast, we were the surface lookouts, because the ship had no radar in those days, so they had to depend on sailors with the glasses to search the seas for other ships.
Were you stationed on the USS Pennsylvania right from your training?
No. In 1938, when I joined the Navy, shortly after that, when they formed our band, we went on a shakedown cruise of a new light cruiser, the Phoenix, I believe it was the name. We went to South America, on the east coast of South America, down as far as Buenos Aires, and then we came back up the same way. And then we went back to the school for a little more training. Then we went to New York City to Flushing, where they had the 1940 World's Fair there, and we lived in tents on the edge of the fairgrounds. And every day we marched into the fair and we played Colors and the arrivals of all the important the visitors they had coming. And after that, we went back to the school for a little more training. And then, that was 39, I believe, not 39. We went to, we were assigned to a cruiser in the Pacific Fleet. So we left Norfolk by an ammunition ship and went around through the canal to the West Coast. And we joined our ship there. It was a light cruiser. The Honolulu, I believe it was that, was the name of that one. And we stayed on the Honolulu until the middle of 1941, when our Admiral Kimmel was selected to be Sinkpack Fleet. And the Admiral's ship was the battleship Pennsylvania. So when he moved to the Pennsylvania, he liked our band, so we traveled there with him. That was the reason that we were there at the time.
When would you say that you arrived at Pearl Harbor?
Late 39, they sent the Pacific Fleet to Pearl Harbor because they thought eventually that they might be having trouble there. So,
how did your fellow mates and all feel about war with Japan? Did you feel that that was coming?
We all thought that it was a possibility. We were lookouts, so they were studying little cards with pictures of Japanese planes and Japanese ships. So if we happened to see one, we would know what they were. But we were not concerned with it too much.
Take me to the night before that attack on Pearl Harbor.
The night before, we were playing a dance band concert at in the big hall on the 1010 dock, and the swing bands were playing, and each band would play a set of three, and then the other band would play another set. One was on one side of the hall, and one on the other. And we played that. We did that to about 11 o'clock, a little bit later. And since our battleship was in dry dock close to there, so a lot of our crew were there. So the winner was won by the amount of applause that they received. So we had most of our crew on the ship. So I think that's one of the reasons why we were selected to be the winner of that thing. The other bands, each battleship had a band, and even though they weren't playing, I think they all come over to listen. So we the Arizona band crew was there, and of course they were all about the same age as we were. That they were band number 22, and they left about midnight with the on their launch to go back to their ship.
All right, well, take us to December 7th, 1941, and explain that day to us.
In our group of battleships, it was our turn to play Morning Colors. So we were lined up on the stern of the of our battleship. We were in the dry dock, and we were overlooking the whole harbor. And it was a beautiful morning, and we had decided to go play tennis that morning. But at 5 minutes to eight, we saw a line of planes come in over the left. And a small plane, small prop planes, and the first one peeled off and dropped something. I thought maybe some of the tail had come off or something, so I watched it until it hit a hangar over on the air station, and that exploded up in flames and smoke and a lot of noise, which startled us, really. We looked back up and saw the big red spots on the fuselage of the airplanes. So immediately it dawned on us that was the Japanese were there. And at that time, a plane that came down from our left, from the entrance of the harbor, a torpedo plane, and I could see it drop its torpedo right by our stern. It was headed to some ships on the left. I saw the wooden floats come off the torpedoes, so the torpedoes wouldn't sink in the mud. And the man in the aft cockpit of the torpedo plane had a machine gun that looked like he was firing at us. You could see the red flashes of the machine gun. You could hear the metal clips on the turret behind us. He was shooting a little bit high, but. The torpedo went under the, I believe the, it was the Aglala, the mine lane ship, and hit a cruiser which was alongside it on the pier. And the Aglala was a wooden ship, so I could see all the wood flying up through the air. And at that time, of course, this all happened with a matter of seconds, like it seemed like all the same time, and. And then we knew we had to get down to the battle station. And at that time, throughout the ship, you could hear the signs, general quarters, no drill. So me and a friend I had in the band, we were assigned to the aft repair party. So we started down that way. As we're going down the ladders, we went through the compartment where we slept. So I took my French horn and I put it under my mattress. I didn't know whether that was going to help or not. But we went down to our repair party and we sat there. course, everybody sat on the steel deck because there's no chairs around it. After quite a while, we felt the ship shake. So we know that we had received a bomb hit. The ship got extremely warm because there were two destroyers in the dry dock with us, and they were smashed, and all the oil had leaked into the dry dock, was on fire. So the sides of the ship was on fire with all the paint that they had on the ship. And the gunner who was in charge of our group began to get real worried with the heat, because our main guns used black powder, which was very explosive, and he was afraid it'd get too hot, that the powder might explode. But they were able to flood the dry dock a little bit in order to put the fires out, so we were safe from that. But then we got word, my friend and I, who had a stretcher, and that was our job there. So we were assigned to go pick up the dead and the wounded people.
Now, you mentioned when that plane came in, you were close enough to see the bullets coming out of the gun.
Oh, yes.
How close, explain to us how close that really was.
It was probably about 100 foot, maybe 150 foot is all.
So you could see the plane clearly.
Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. And if I close my eyes, I can still see it.
Still see that.
Right.
Now, you said that you were in charge of or part of the stretcher crew, so you helped...
Right. There was two of us assigned to the aft repair party, and two other... The BAM was... the members were spread around the ship where they needed men to do stuff like that.
What's the one memory that sticks in your mind from that day?
The main memory was the problem we had trying to pick up someone who was close to the blast of the bomb and the explosions, because the flesh was all burnt, so you couldn't pick them up by the flesh. You had to pick them up by the shoes, and then the uniform was undershirts and white shorts at that time. So we had a problem getting them up off the deck into the stretcher, and the smell of the burnt flesh is still something that remains with me. So.
And what did you from there? Where did you go?
They were able to repair us enough, because the bomb went down through the middle. It didn't disturb the engines or anything. So I think it was 12 days later we left. We left Pearl Harbor, our battleship, and we have one destroyer as an escort. And we went north looking for the fleets of the Japanese fleets or anything. We went up around Alaska and the Aleutians, then back down along the coast, the west coast, and about a month later, we arrived in San Francisco, and they put our ship into the repair yards there.
My name is Herb Weatherwax. I was born in Honolulu on June 3rd, 1917. I heard a very loud explosion in Honolulu, and I looked in the direction of the explosion. That was over Pearl Harbor. And I saw the sky just black with smoke, a big cloud of smoke. And I could hear the anti-aircraft guns firing. I could hear that boom, 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 which is a sound I was familiar with, because they used to have dry runs in that particular area. So I turned the radio on to find out what was going on, and they announced over the radio that all military personnel report to the station immediately. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor. It was more than a material damages that was done. It affected the lives of all the young men that were here at that time, that were involved, and was entrapped in the ships that was bombed, and especially the Arizona. I visited Memorial quite frequently and get to talk to the people about how it was that morning, how I saw it. When I was called back to my station, I got on a bus in Honolulu, and the bus is a regular transportation that troops had at that time to go to Honolulu and back to Schofield Barracks. And as I passed by the Arizona, right at the entrance of the bay, I looked out and I was just shocked to see such a huge ship just enveloped in flames. The flames were so huge. And the sight that I saw there with all the other battleships ablaze, and the Oklahoma had been already torpedoed and she flipped over on the side. And I remember seeing little objects scrambling on the hull of the Oklahoma. Those are the things that left a tremendous impression on my mind. I volunteered for the visitor center because this is an opportunity for me to give my story out to the hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of visitors that come out here. I have story to pass on to let them know how things were to be and they should be. And I think that the people, every American, if it's possible, should come to Hawaii and visit the memorial. Especially, never miss the memorial. That's very, very important.
And now we've come to the end of the program. I hope you've enjoyed ACP's Pearl Harbor retrospective. I hope you enjoyed the stories. I hope they resonated positively with you. I hope you found them inspiring. Tom Brokaw wasn't always right, but he was eminently correct when he assessed these men and women, the people that took part in this great cataclysm of war, the greatest generation. That's all the time we have. We'll talk to you next week when we take a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. In the meantime, God bless you. God bless America. We'll see you then.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Yeah, we'll meet again. I don't know where, and I don't know when, But I do know that we'll meet again some sunny day. So honey, keep on smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive all the dark clouds far away. And will you please say hello to all the folks that I know and tell them that I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song.
We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.